Hey, everybody, it's Justin Shackle welcoming you into episode 37 of Toe in the Slab, Pitching with David Cohn, where we discuss the art of pitching every single week here. We do it with a guy who knows what he's talking about. It's the Cy Young Award winner, the five-time World Series champ, David Cohn, the research maven, James Smythe, and myself. And guys, we kind of lied to our listeners way back when. I think it was like the 10th episode of this podcast where we did our first mailbag and we said, hey, we'll do this often. Well, it's episode 37. So we're long overdue for a mailbag episode. So David, James, hope you guys are having a good long weekend here. We are recording on Memorial Day and this is a perfect time to say, hey, we remember all of those who have served and pay the ultimate sacrifice for our freedom. So we think about you today. We think about you every day. Guys, big weekend in baseball, the Yankees and the Rays coming off a big series. And David, for you, Sunday Night Baseball at Citi Field, the Mets finding a way to win it. I think you could say that about them plenty of times this season. That was exciting at Citi Field Sunday night.
It really was. If you think about it, I mean, the crowd was electric. I mean, the Mets got something going on in Queens, that's for sure. And the people are reacting to it. The whole culture feels different there. So first of all, 37 episodes already. Wow. That's
we're rolling through.
Wow. Yeah. That slapped me in the face a little bit there. Yeah. We definitely are getting into it, but it was a heartbreaking loss for the Phillies too. You know, I got a chance to talk to Joe Girardi, my guy before the game, my catcher. And you can tell that, you know, he's feeling it a little bit, although he's steady as a rock. You know, Joe doesn't worry about his job, but you're in Philly. You're on the hot seat. You know that he hears it, but you know he was well prepared for what's coming this way. He managed the Yankees, obviously. He was fired from the Yankees after a pretty successful year, so he's been through the ringer. So he's the right guy to handle the pressure in Philly. But another late loss, you know, and you could just if you looked at Nick Castellanos' face on the bench, you know, he hit a big three-run home run to give him the lead. He's the hero, maybe a signature moment. And then the aftermath of the game, the look on his face, the contrast just told the story.
When you talk about Joe Girardi and the pressure that the team's facing, do you mean the pressure he's facing for potentially his job status or just weathering the team through this rocky start in a really crowded NL East? Because we don't see too many managerial firings in during the season anymore, right?
Yeah, no, it's true, but it's Philadelphia and the media is certainly, talking about, you know, what's going on there in Philly. And the thing that gets a manager on the hot seat quicker than anything is late game losses. Like the Phillies are suffering seemingly on a regular basis at this point. And nothing is more demoralizing. You know, I've said this before and it bears repeating that, wow, you get an offensive night. That team is built around offense and slugging. The Phillies from top to bottom should score a bunch of runs. You would think that's the way they were constructed. Defense is going to be, you know, they knew going in, it was going to be a challenge defensively. It has been. Bryce Harper stuck in the DH role. You can't use the DH role and get some relief there and maybe get some defense on the field. So yes, you have to know in the back of your mind when the media is asking you these questions on a daily basis and Philadelphia media is, are you worried about your job? And Joe Girardi's like, no, that's not what I'm worried about. And it's truthful. It's truthful. Joe doesn't worry about his job. That's just how he's made up. But wow. Just when you get those demoralizing late losses and another one on Sunday night, that's just a killer. And on the back end of a sweep too, you know, they lost the first two games of the series. They finally had chance to redeem themselves in the third game and then coughed it up late. And that's a tough one.
All right. We have a lot to get to with all of your questions that you submitted. And there are some really good ones. James and I are going to kind of read them off to David as we go along here on this episode, but we start off each week with the opener. We're not going to change it now, even though it's a mailbag episode. David, what do you have for us as we begin episode 37 here?
Well, I know we've talked about this before, but just, you know, talking to Buck Showalter before Sunday night's game and Joe Girardi as well. And as I tend to kind of gather information on what they think about the future of the game and the direction, everybody's still talking about the pitch clock. And, you know, we talk about the 25% mark in the season, the holiday Memorial Day weekend, everybody's taking inventory, who's where in the standings, when, you know, what the projections are. Everybody's talking about still like, wow, the pitch clock is a dynamic change in the minor leagues. And they're at not quite the 25% point in the minor leagues. They start a little bit later, or actually this year with the lockout, they're pretty close. So yes, it's going to be dramatic. Buck Showalter made a point of saying this to me before the game of, I don't think people realize what a dramatic effect this is going to have on the game. Now, you know, we talk about pitch calm this year is kind of pick up the pace a little bit with the pitchers and the electronic signal calling. Wait till next year. The pitch clock is going to be dramatic. I'm not sure if it's going to be 14 seconds with nobody on base like it is in the minor leagues, and I think 19 seconds with runners on base. That's still to kind of be hashed out and negotiated. Wherever that falls, it's going to be a dramatic impact on the pace of play and that domino effect on down through of pitchers and maximum effort between pitches and taking their time. No, you got to work faster. The batter's going to stay in the box. You know, that's going to have a residual effect on a lot of different things that we don't quite realize yet. But yes, it's a big deal coming next year.
I guess you could call like PitchCom this year the appetizer, and then the big one will be the pitch clock coming up. James, we were talking about it right before we started recording, like the time of game, specifically with the Yankees, because they make note of it on the TV broadcast. Feels like they're getting in their work in short order here, but obviously the pitch clock's not in play. There's a combination of what's gone on with the Yankees specifically, but the time of games definitely shrunk, right, in 2021?
Yeah, so far this year, we'll go back to last year, average time of a 9-inning game in 2021 was 3 hours and 10 minutes. So far this year, it's down to 3:05. So that's 5 minutes shorter than last year. And that's with the average number of plate appearances and pitches per game, pitches per plate appearance, all around pretty similar to last year. So that 5 minutes is being made up in time between pitches. And I think, as Aaron Boone has said, other managers have said, PitchCom is a big part of that. And I think, like you said, with the PitchCom being the appetizer, next year really throw it into overdrive with the pitch clock. In the minor leagues, Jason Stark had a column about some trends around the league this year. He noted the pitch clock shortening games in the minor leagues as of the other day, 28 minutes shorter than last year, the average time of game, going from 3:03 in the minors to 2:35 with the pitch clock. I don't know if it'll be that dramatic if it comes to the big leagues next year, but the pace of play is definitely going to be shortened. And we've talked about it before, but the residual downstream effects that Coney brought up about pitchers not going max effort, that could drive more contact in the game, and we could have some residual effects there.
Guys, one more item before we open up the mailbag, and only bringing it up, David, because you were talking about Buck Showalter here. Our good friend Michael Kay on the Yankees broadcast this past weekend, he brought up the fact that both the Yankees and the Mets are in first place on Memorial Day for the first time since 1988. That's all terrific. You know, obviously up until this point, that's a good thing, a good place to be in, sort of. But David, can you kind of put into perspective how little of the season has really been played here? And I'm talking about going back to your days playing. There's still so much to come. Do you have any examples from your playing career of just how long seasons last?
It's a great question, Shaq. I mean, every year it seems like we get a reminder or need a reminder of that exact point of how long the season is, how the ebbs and flows can swing week to week, month to month, how individual fan bases sort of set their hair on fire because, you know, this player's got to go, this manager's got to go, this team is a wreck. And then you see, you know, last year, the Atlanta Braves with a big second half end up winning the World Series. So yes, 1988, the Mets were in first place on this date. So were the Yankees. The Yankees fell out. The Yankees didn't make it. The Mets did in 1988. They won the National League East. So yeah, there's always that reminder that, you know what, just hang in there. Joe Girardi's message to the Philly fan base last night was it will turn. The extra caveat this year is the expanded postseason. You know, as part of the collective bargaining agreement, that the number of teams that get in up to 12 this year, that's a big bearing on things. You're not out of it. Trade deadline is going to be at the end of July, first of August. There's hard to make trades now. It's hard to improve your team unless it's from within right now. So fan base is calling for trades or maneuvers. It's hard. organizations aren't focused on trades right now, unless it's just an emergency situation or there's a heist going on. They're more focused on the draft coming up. They're more focused on other things internally. So you kind of got to live with what you got, you know? And if you look at the Yankees and some of their injuries, you know, it's from within. You got to go down and dig, unless there's somebody like an outlier, like a Matt Carpenter, right? Somebody like that. That's why the Yankees jumped on him, because you're limited in your maneuvering right now. So yes, expanded postseason. It's still early, but yeah, pretty good snapshot though at the not the quarter pole as we've talked about in the past, but certainly the quarter mark of the season. So yes, stay tuned.
Coney, you were 20-3 with a 2.22 ERA on that 88 Mets team, so I had to squeeze that in there. Great season. And for this year, we are not quite 30% in. We hit the quarter mark, you know, a few games ago. Teams have played 46, 47, 48 games. That's just a tick below 30%. There's still so much baseball left to be played, even though we've already been going for almost 2 months.
And if you want to just go back to that 88 season really quick. You talked about the Yankees being in first place and how they didn't make the postseason in 88. It's not like they just narrowly missed it. I think they finished in fourth or fifth place and missing and I think that was the last time that Billy Martin got fired. They made the managerial change in the middle of that downturn. So yeah, a lot can change with the rest of the schedule coming here in 2022. Okay. Time to open up the mailbag. James and I, we're going to read some questions here. David's going to answer them. And we'll just have a clean discussion as fans chime in and we'll get the ball rolling. You guys did a terrific job sending in some really insightful questions just about the state of the game, about certain teams, but also pitching as a whole, as a craft. So we want to get to a bunch of them here. All right. First question comes at JRockKRocks14. This was submitted to Toe in the Slab and actually had my handle on it too. So I guess that's why it's popping up first here. When you did not have a good bullpen before a game, David, how were you able to put that behind you, if you did, and be able to adjust once the game began?
The point of maturity. Yes, that was when I looked at my career. And there was a point, I think, when I finally made it to the Yankees. And I spent 6 years with the Mets in the early part, 1987, 1988, we just mentioned. And then in the mid-90s, I came to the Yankees. And that's when I realized that how you warmed up in the bullpen didn't matter as much. And I didn't worry about it. As a young pitcher, I really worried about it. Well, I just kept pounding. I'd throw longer bullpens before the games, almost wearing myself out. You know, I got to find this, my slider, my fastball. It's not quite there. And just overridden with anxiety. And that really is something you have to learn on your own. It's a pitching coach can't teach you that. It's more emotional than anything. This is an emotional IQ as a pitcher. And that's a whole different realm that's hard to quantify. It's hard to put a number on, but it's something you feel. It's like a light bulb effect where, you know what? I'm okay. I'm just loosening. The purpose of the bullpen before the game is just to get my arm loose, get my body loose, to prepare myself for what's going to happen during the game. Nothing's happening down here that's going to impact, you know, when a batter steps in the box, which changes everything. Once a batter steps in the box with a baseball bat, that's when the whole thing changes, and that's when it counts. So when you realize that, when you understand that as a pitcher and you fully buy in, then you stop worrying about your bullpens before the game, because there's many times when the old cliche is, you know, man, I felt really great warming up before the game. And then I got on the mound and I totally sucked, and vice versa. You know, there's many examples, and pitchers throughout history have talked about this. You know, as David Wells talked about, the worst bullpen he ever had in his life was before his perfect game. You know, there's so many stories like that. And that's the point of maturity as a young pitcher. When you finally figure that out, then you have arrived, in my mind, on how you prepare for a game.
Does that happen to everybody? Is it like a rite of passage?
I think it does. Yes, it certainly does. You know, some learn the lesson earlier than others. But if you wear yourself out before the game, and then you get in there and you're almost gassed in the first inning. Learning how to warm up is so important. Learning what's important, what's not, stay in your lane, and understand, you know, that when you get into the game, things can change any to any. There were so many games I pitched where, man, a curveball's not there today. But by the second or third inning, all of a sudden it shows up. It's there. You don't give up on pitches throughout the game. Just because you don't have good stuff in the first inning on certain pitches, you bring them along, keep them in your back pocket, keep trying to work them into a game, because by the third time through the order, that's the key. That's when it shows up, when you've got the rough edges worn off, so to speak. And a lot of young pitchers aren't given this opportunity in the minor leagues or in the big leagues nowadays because they're taken out of the game. And the data shows you that the third time through the order, a lot of starting pitchers really diminish the familiarity of the hitters and the pitchers. It really impacts the how well the pitchers do on that third time through the order, that magical, you know, trip through the order. To me, that goes right to the heart of, you know what, that curveball in the second inning, it wasn't there. It's now there for the third time through the order. It gives you a different look. It gives you another weapon to use to get deeper in the games as a starter. And it's kind of a lost art in today's game.
All right, we'll take the next one. At K McAwesome, Kenneth asks, this is similar to the emotional IQ, I think, that you were just talking about, but how does a pitcher stay in and get back into a groove mentally after an ump calls ball four on what should be strike three to end the inning? We got a couple similar questions like this around the Garrett Cole, G-Man Choi ball four and the subsequent run in Saturday's game at the Trop between the Yankees and the Rays.
Yeah, it's very similar to the first answer. You're right, James, but you know, there's a fine line. There's a balance there. You know, pitchers who pitch with emotion, sometimes it's a good thing. If you dial it back too much and become sort of a zombie on the mound, then you lose that edge. You know, Garrett Cole pitches with an edge. We know it. We've seen him. We've seen him enough to know that when you see that reaction, you know, to a called third strike that was missed, did he really get out of his game afterwards? You know, how do you rein that in to where emotionally you don't overreact and then it becomes a distraction to your next pitch? And, you know, I've always said that the best pitchers are the ones that kind of, or the best ball players really in general, are the ones that have amnesia. You can, you know, that's sort of the mental training that you can just forget about that. Forget about the things that you can't control. And just, you know, there's plenty of time after the game. Plenty of time to dissect it after the game, get mad about it, bitch and moan about calls or this or that or run support. You can process that after the game. The trick during the game is just to file it, you know, turn the page and move on to the next batter. But at the same time, there's different personality types, and pitchers to pitch with edges like that, pitch with emotion, that's a hard thing. It's a hard thing not to get overheated in a moment like that. With respect to Garrett Cole in that game yesterday, I'm not sure that happened to him. I know he was upset that the call was missed, but it was a borderline call right up at the top of the zone. You know, it certainly was a strike in the K box. Certainly easily could have been called a strike three against a guy, KJ Choi, that has kind of given him problems, right? You could see Garrett Cole was really fired up about that at bat. He really wanted KJ Choi yesterday. Almost stared him down in the first at bat when he struck him out. So that was an interesting little dynamic there between pitcher and hitter there that have a little bit of a history against each other.
So for all you developing pitchers, look, you're going to have plenty of time when you rest your head on your pillow to lose sleep over the calls that didn't go your way. But during the moment, get hyper-focused. All right, next one from at SlowTrain22. He'd like to hear a bit more about footwork on the mound, the windup, the stretch, the pickoffs. He wants to know what goes into choosing one's alignment and how that can be paired up with your arm slot.
A lot of it depends on the quality of the mound you're pitching on. You know, in youth baseball and in training nowadays, a lot of pitchers, young pitchers, are throwing off of artificial mounds, you know, sort of the AstroTurf mounds when they're practicing and training. And then when you get on an actual dirt or clay mound, what is the quality of the composition that you're working with? How big is the hole in front of the rubber? To me, that's where it starts. Your starting point, when you're digging out your marks, your holes in front of the rubber, that's your push-off point. That's a key starting point. And then the next one, obviously, is where you land. What is the quality of the composition of the mound where you're landing? Are there big holes there? Who's your opposing pitcher? What holes did he dig out? Are you landing in his hole? Do you have some big donkey, you know, that's got the size 13 shoe that dug out a big hole right where you want to land? And if you land half in and out, half in and half out of that hole, you're going to roll your ankle or twist and there's no stability. So there's so many variables involved in your alignment, where you land, how you land, and who your opposing pitcher is, and how you have to work around sort of a minefield out there, especially in amateur ball. Some of these mounds aren't very high quality. So that's the one thing you have to be able to do is adjust. There were certain starts in my career where I had to move to the opposite side of the mound. You know, I like to pitch from both sides, generally the first base side, because I was slightly closed. So if you land slightly closed in your alignment, generally, you want to be, if a right-handed pitcher, on the first base side, because it can free up your hips a little bit. If you're all the way on the third base side of the rubber as a right-handed pitcher and you land across your body, then you're kind of fighting gravity. You got to reach way back over here to get the ball over to the outside corner or inside to a lefty. So there's so many layers to this as you peel them back. But the ability to adjust on the mound around those sorts of things, I highly encourage. So I would practice that in between starts. Okay, let me come all the way over to the third base side of the mound and let me throw my pitches there and get a feel for it. Let me switch back to the first base side of the mound and let me get a feel for release points and my alignment there and see how that works. And sometimes that's a great adjustment mechanism during the game too. If you're really struggling, let me switch it up here and give a different look and be able to do that and have the confidence to do that is one of the keys, I think, in working around the dynamics of just alignment, the mound, how you work with the holes, how you work with your alignment. It's a big deal, especially if you're not used to pitching off of dirt mounds. If all of your training is done off of AstroTurf mounds, that's an underrated facet of what you have to deal with as a pitcher.
When you were playing, was there an opposing pitcher who just kind of like laid out a crater on their landing spot that made all the other pitchers pretty mad?
You know, Randy Johnson was that way because he's such a big dude, right? Big guy, lefty, and you know he pitched kind of in the middle, but he had a big old, you know, I think it had to be like a 14. I think he was a size 14, and he was tough to work around because he left like elephant marks on the mound when he pitched. So you really had to work around the big unit out there, and there were a lot of pitchers. Some pitchers were diggers. You know, if you are on the road, if you're a visiting pitcher on the road, you're the second pitcher to see the mound. The starting pitcher at home would go out and he gets first crack at it. And some guys were just diggers. They dig out huge craters in front of the rubber. And that really bothered me more than anything. The starting point, it felt like you were throwing uphill. You had to get up and over that crater in front of the rubber. And the thing is that most pitchers don't want to take the time to call the grounds crew out. You have the ability to do that, to call the grounds crew and fill it back in and pound it back down. But then the opposing guy will just dig it back out again. And then you're just slowing down the game and the crowd starts booing you. And so very few pitchers have the onions to be able to say, hey, time out, look at this hole. Home plate umpire, come out. Hey, grounds crew, come out. Let's pound this back down. You don't see that happen too often. I saw Zach Greinke do that once, and then he laid down and took a nap behind the mound like only Greinke can. So that was probably the best one I ever saw, was Zach Greinke laying down on the mound while the grounds crew's pounding down the holes in front of the mound.
So you got the next one from Braden at Fasto Jetso. Pitchers can tip pitches, as we all know, but is the opposite true for batters? Are there signs / body language from a batter that lets pitchers know that they're expecting a certain kind of pitch?
Occasionally, yes. I don't think it's quite as prevalent as it used to be, but batters back in the 70s and 80s would move around in the batter's box more. I think hitters today generally kind of stay in the same spot. They want to get all the way back. A lot of them dig out the white line in the back of the batter's box, and they want to be pretty deep in the box and kind of stay there. But a lot of hitters would move up in the box and move on the plate a little more back in the day. If you moved up in the batter's box, they're looking for off-speed pitches. You know, somebody who featured a lot of curveballs or a lot of changeups, you'd want to get closer to him to shorten up the time because the pitch was slower. Generally, when you're deeper in the box, it gives you more time if the pitch is faster. So, really hard thrower, you wouldn't want to be up in the box. So I don't think that's as prevalent anymore. I think it's more about reading the bat. It's more reactionary in terms of how did he swing at that fastball? Was he really late? Did he take a fastball down the middle early in the count? Oh, he's sitting breaking ball. Probably he's looking for something else. So I think that's more what I looked for and what current pitchers look for is more of how the batter reacts to the pitches. So the reading the bat that you hear about certainly is a real thing and an art that pitchers do and catchers as well. So yeah, that's the cat and mouse game between pitcher and hitter. And that's what I looked at. I think there's a feedback on every pitch. The hitter gives you feedback. There's feedback first on what the location. I was trying to throw it down and away, and I missed up and in. I know, you know, mechanically what I did wrong. You know, I flew open. I was a little quick, or my arm was a little fast. If conversely, if I threw it in the dirt and to the left, you know, I held onto the ball too long. I knew what my mechanical adjustment was. And secondly, the feedback of the hitter. How did he react to that pitch? And how did he swing at it? And what am I looking at here? And is he guessing? Is he late? Why change? The old school theory is if he shows you something that he can't do, why change from it? We saw that in last night's game with Adam Ottavino, maybe outthinking himself, giving up a 3-run home run to Nick Castellanos. one of the best sliders in the game, one of the best fastball hitters in the game. Let me try to throw a fastball by him. He ends up giving a 3-run home run. So yes, those sorts of things matter in terms of reading the batter, reading yourself first. And yes, that it's still a big part of the game, but kind of a lost art too, as well.
Getting the feedback of the hitter, something that's always stood out to me when I first read it in your book that you did with Jack Curry. Hope, by the way, has another book out with Paul O'Neill. Congratulations to Jack and Paul for swinging a hit.
Yes.
But that was definitely one of the things that jumped out at me upon reading it, because it was the first time I heard someone talk about it. Didn't register. So next one's from at James T. Viestra. And this is completely relatable to you, David, okay? So James has a 16-year-old son who pitches, and he's 6'5", 190 pounds, so right in your wheelhouse here. But he wants to know if you have any tips for a 16-year-old kid who's 6'5", a buck 90, because it seems to him that his son's overpowering right now against other kids his age.
Yes. Wow. The thing that I recommend to, you know, even though in today's environment, there are a lot of different theories and a lot of different ways to train. It's one of the biggest advancements in the game. We tend to talk about sabermetrics or analytics, but the medical data on how to train is probably one of the most significant changes over the last 5 years. We've seen organizations revamp their whole medical staff, the Yankees included. You know, Steve Donahue's still there, the old school trainer that rode the buses and ate ketchup sandwiches with all the minor league players coming up through and paid his dues. He's still there, but nowadays it's much more sophisticated with biomechanics and injury prevention, velocity training. There's a lot of avenues out there that are interesting to look at. So I would have to say, what is his training? What are his training methods now? Is he using a weighted baseball? Is he using different tricks of the trade, so they say out there, whether it's a body blade, the high vibration training, or as I said, the weighted ball training? I'd have to evaluate that first to see where he's at. But just to me, some of the old school things you can do: continue to long toss, continue to develop your ability to extend. One of the best things he can have at being 6'5 and that tall is extension. And we saw that last night with Zach Wheeler on the Phillies, has 7 feet, 2 inches of extension. How close you release the ball to home plate is an advantage for bigger, taller guys. So pay attention to your stride length. Pay attention to reaching out. That's why long toss can help you reach out there and develop that extension. One of the underrated facets of pitching, and the theory behind it is that the closer you can release the ball to home plate, the shorter the distance is. And that gives you that jump, that acceleration that hitters talk about, that, man, that just jumped on me. I got here quicker than I thought. So the difference between actual velocity and perceived velocity, two different things that can actually be impacted by the extension on your pitches. So at that size, at 16 years old, you hope you keep growing. You hope you keep getting stronger. But think about extension. Think about reaching out there. And just an old, good old-fashioned long toss program can help with that.
Guys, you can slide into stacks of cash this baseball season with DraftKings Sportsbook, an official sports betting partner of Major League Baseball. New customers can bet just $5 on any team to win and get $150 in free bets no matter what, win or lose. If you're looking to turn a small bet into a big payday during the baseball season, you can do it with DraftKings Same Game Parlays. You create your own parlay. You combine multiple bets like which team's going to win, how many bases will be stolen, total runs in the game. It's your shot at an even bigger payout. DraftKings is safe, secure, and reliable. And best of all, you can deposit and withdraw your cash whenever you want. Download the DraftKings Sportsbook app now. Use promo code SLAB, bet just $5, and get $150 in free bets no matter what happens on the field. That's promo code SLAB at DraftKings Sportsbook, an official sports betting partner of Major League Baseball. Minimum age and eligibility restrictions apply. See show notes for details. MLB trademarks used with permission.
Next one from Four Train Savages. How do you think your rhythm on the mound would change, if at all, when using PitchCom? Would you have to do anything different?
I think the thing is there's, we there's a pre-shot routine. So, you know, golfers talk about a pre-shot routine. Basketball players talk about shooting on the move. You know, I mentioned it last week in last week's episode about Roldis Chapman and how you initiate movement. You know, starting from a static position in every sport is a tricky thing. You know, how do you get started? You know, just standing flat-footed, initiating that motion is a bigger issue than you think it is. So, you know, for me, I think, when you think about rhythm and tempo, if you're used to like bending down, getting the sign and then coming set, yeah, all of a sudden you got to pay attention to that rhythm, because if you get somebody in your ear giving you the sign or giving you the code and you hear fastball down and away and you're just now getting on the rubber and you're like, okay, how do I start this motion? That initial starting mechanism can get thrown off just a little bit. And it's really important, more than you think. So yes, you've got to adjust to that and get a rhythm and a sequence going. And when do you push the button if you're the catcher? Wait till I'm on the mound. Wait till I'm ready and I'm set. Now give it to me. And now I can kind of simulate the same thing I've done my whole career and not throw off that initial starting mechanism. You know, golfers, they talk about a little forward press before I start my swing. Every sport has that. You name a sport, whatever, whoever's doing a dynamic athletic motion has a trigger, just something to get the sequence of events into play. And, I'm a big believer in that. And, you know, that is just so important, because if you don't have that little checkpoint to begin the motion, then all of a sudden you start to rush your sequence of events, your chain, the kinetic chain gets thrown off a little bit. So that's something that, it's hard to train for. It's hard to talk about. It's hard to quantify, but it's very real. And yes, yeah, that's something you have to compensate for with PitchCom.
This next one's interesting. It comes from at Farhandrew Z. So I think this is a Dodgers fan. He wants to know, why is it so much harder to throw a backdoor slider cutter versus a chase slider cutter?
A lot of it is alignment. You know, and a lot of it is how you're trained. You know, in order to throw, you know, the type of spin you're trying to impart on a baseball to make a break, and the spin axis. Now that we measure every pitch now, you know, whether we, you know, the Y or the X and Y axis, how the ball spins, the axis of the spin is really important, not just the RPMs and how quickly it spins. When you're getting the axis just to the right point, you know, if you're on a clock, say at 10 o'clock, you want this axis so you get a two-plane break. You want vertical movement and horizontal movement. In order to impart that spin with the type of grip and the axis that you get, you want it to spin tightly and go to down and away. If you're a right-handed pitcher, you're trained to like get that tight spin and make it go down and away. If you're trying to backdoor it, it's almost like your alignment. You have to aim over here, and you want to start it in a place that you're a little bit unfamiliar with. In your release point, it's not the way you're training generally to throw your best breaking stuff. So it really is a sort of an alignment and where you set your eyes in terms of where you're going to start the pitch, because it's not at the glove. Most people think, maybe if you've never pitched before, that, you know, focus on the glove. You hear that in Little League games. Look at the glove, you know, throw it to the glove. Well, actually I'm aiming it over here. The glove's the last thing I'm thinking about. I'm actually aiming it over his right shoulder. You know, the catcher's right shoulder, or I used to say shin guards, you know, when catchers would spread out, I'm like, I'm going to aim for your left shin guard and then break it over the outside corner. So you're fixating on where you start the pitch is really important. And backdoor pitches, generally speaking, are a little bit unnatural at first, because that's not something that you practice on as a little leaguer, or when you first start throwing breaking balls, that's not the initial objective. You want to see that big one that breaks down and goes down in the dirt and away. And those are the ones that spin tight. That's the way you learned initially how to throw breaking balls. So it's almost the opposite of that when you're throwing backdoor pitches, or some people call them backup pitches, but it's really about where you start it and where your alignment is that really impact on side to side, in and out kind of control, east to west control of your breaking pitches as well as your fastball.
I'll take these as the stats and research guy. A couple from, it's a combo from at JBoss underscore and from at BenNYY underscore 25. What personal stat did you care most about when you played? And a follow-up to that being, what stat would you care about most now if you were a player?
To me, it was always innings pitched. was workload. I thought that was a residual effect that could really impact giving your bullpen a rest, giving your manager a rest, knowing that you're going to get deeper into the games. You know, for the majority of my career up until the end, I think I averaged 7 innings a start. That was the one that I was most proud of. That's the one I think about. I still think it's important, probably even more important because there's fewer guys that can do that nowadays. Or if you've got a pitcher that can do that, even though it's kind of trending upward this year in a pitcher dominant environment now, run scoring's down a bit. We've seen a few pitchers, few starting pitchers, especially the good ones, getting a little deeper in the game. So that was it for me. I wanted to get as deep into the game as I possibly could. Innings pitch was it. Everything else was kind of subjected to random variance. You know, how good's my defense behind me? How good's my run support? I was a big early adopter of pitchers' won loss records can be deceiving. And Keith Hernandez taught me that early on with the Mets. Your won loss record is more indicative of what type of team you play on. You play on a really good team, you're going to have a good won loss record. Even he knew that back in the 80s. And that was an early lesson for me. And I used it in arbitration cases as well. And one loss record's overrated. You know, I'm doing my job. I pitched as many innings as I could. I kept our team in the game. And what happens beyond that is out of my control. So, yes, innings pitch then, innings pitch now.
All right. At R4CCS wants to know which pitch has revolutionized the game more in the past year.
It is interesting to see the ebbs and flows, you know, in the so-called spider tack era. It was four seamers up in the zone. We saw that with Garrett Cole coming over from Pittsburgh. Hey, your sinker's not that good. Maybe you should hold a cross seam and, you know, maybe get a little help along the way. Right. So a lot of pitchers were using a little help with the sticky stuff. And you know, it's still kind of an issue today on what the baseball and rosin bags, but I digress. I think, you know, for me, now the two seamers coming back in play. And what I talked to Aaron Judge earlier this year. And if you're a pitcher that can feature both two seamer and four seamer, that is really wreaking havoc with hitters. They're trying to guess fastball in. If it's a right-handed pitcher against a right-handed batter, Aaron Judge told me, boy, I almost have to guess whether it's a two seamer or a four seamer. And that little subtle nuance, that little dynamic of, is it going to run in or is it going to stay straight and ride? And that is a big deal. So that combination of two-seamer back into play, and certainly the cutter off of that as well. We're seeing a lot of cutters back in play as well. And back to, Mariano Rivera. You know, how many relievers do we see that have emulated Mariano Rivera? Kenley Jansen with his cutter for years. So, yes, to me, it's that interplay between the tunneling effect between two-seamers and four-seamers and then the cutter off of that. Is really unique. So I they're kind of all fastballs, really. It's a cut fastball. A sinker is a fastball. And obviously a four-seamer is what everybody knows as a traditional fastball, but they're all in the genre of fastballs and the subtle nuances between those and the tunneling effect and the evaluation of the spin rates on those pitches really, to me, is interesting that pitchers are using to their advantage right now.
When Aaron Judge is talking about almost trying to have to guess whether it's a four-seamer or a two-seamer, is he talking about guessing in a fastball count before the pitch even leaves the pitcher's hand, or is there enough time for him to start guessing when that ball is leaving the pitcher's hand?
Yeah, I it's very hard to pick up the difference in rotation on two-seamer and four-seamer. Maybe you can a little bit. It's a lot different than seeing spin, you know, like a slider spin or gyro spin. Maybe you can pick up that. If you're a hitter about halfway to home plate, fastballs are harder, but yeah, you know, this guy's coming inside. He's going to throw fastballs in. It's a right-handed pitcher against a right-handed batter. I know at some point in this at bat, he's going to come in on me maybe a couple or three times. Now is it, okay, I'm going to go get that. Oh, it's a two seamer and it runs in off the plate and breaks my bat. Or I got to pull a foul or it induces weak contact and gets him to chase a pitch out of the strike zone. Whereas the four-seamer stays on the plate and maybe it stays up just a little bit more than the sinker or two-seamer would. So that guessing game, that recognition issue right there is really tricky for hitters nowadays because the pitchers are generally understanding the difference between two. And, you know, maybe early in the count, I'm going to run two-seamers in and then late in the count, I'm going to finish with four-seamers. So that's where the guessing game comes in terms of trying not just to recognize, but to kind of guess along and understand the patterns of a certain pitcher and what he's trying to do. That's another thing. I think there's so much more information nowadays, not just information, but analysts that that spend 4 hours before every game analyzing every tendency of the hitter and the pitcher. You know, it's amazing that the prep that goes into it now. There's four or five different analytics guys that are dedicated just to that. You know, that one little facet of breaking down every little detail of what the hitters and the pitchers' tendencies are. It's so much more involved now than obviously it ever has been.
Next question's from our pals over at Talking Yanks. Outside of winning in statistics, what similarities does Coney see between this year's Yankees rotation and the Yankees rotations that he was a part of?
The overall consistency. Yes. I mean, if you think about the 90s Yankees, if you look at that rotation, it seems like year in and year out, everybody took a turn at being number one. You know, you could have rolled the dice and say, okay, El Duque, you're going to start game one. Oh, Andy Pettit, you're going to start game one. Boomer, David Wells, okay, you're going to be the game one pitcher in this series, or even you throw in Rocket after the Boomer era. So, yes, you're starting to get that feel a little bit of it doesn't really matter who's on the mound. They're all kind of ace-like quality starters. You know Gerrit Cole. We know what his pedigree is. Luis Severino was a top five pitcher before his Tommy John surgery and his injuries. He's kind of looking like he's back now. It really encouraging to see him start in and start out, kind of get his entire repertoire back. He's better than ever now, I think. His changeup is better than it's ever been. His combination of slider cutter is better than it's ever been. Nestor Cortez, wow, he might start the All-Star game if he keeps going right now. So, yes, and even Jameson Taillon, when you look at him, he's got ace-like quality to his numbers right now. So there's not a discernible, oh, this is our, you know, the back end of our rotation, number four, oh, this is our fifth starter guy. Roll them together, mix them up, and, you know, throw them all out there. That's kind of what it feels like with this rotation, and that's kind of what we had back in the 90s. So, yeah, that's the similarities I see. It's like, hey, we play today, we win today because of the starting pitcher. That's where it started. You know, Mariano Duncan came up with that, coined that phrase, we play today, we win today. That's it. You know, that's the feeling you get in that clubhouse. And it all starts just because of the rotation and night in and night out, whoever you run out there, you have tremendous confidence in.
All right. We'll go through a Yankee stretch here with some questions. At Goss Jim 358 wants to know, should Yankee fans be worried about the innings already logged by Nestor Cortez and Clay Holmes this year? Cause it kind of seems like they're being used more than ever before.
I would have confidence that the Yankees medical staff and really the entire organization is well aware of this stuff. They're tracking it. These things can be measured nowadays much more than ever before. Back in the day, to overuse that expression, I guess that's what you do when you're in your 50s, pushing 60 years old. You use that expression a little more than you probably should. But it was all eye test back then. It was Mel Stottlemyre and Joe Torre saying, hey, how you feel? Are you okay? Yeah, I'm okay. Yeah, you know, you look okay. Now we're tracking everything, release points. The medical data there is measurable. The spin rates are measurable. Are you dropping your arm? Is there a little downtick in your velocity? Is there downtick in your spin rate? Your release point was here in April and May, and now all of a sudden it's dropping down and to the right or to the left a little bit, which can be a precursor to fatigue. We know that fatigue is the one thing that can lead to injury. So there's more weapons. There's more data than ever before to measure these things, to monitor them. So yes, as you're going along through the season, I feel pretty confident that, hey, Nestor, we're going to skip a start, or Luis Severino, we're going to skip a start. And the overall depth of the organization comes into play that you can reach down in AAA and grab a guy and bring him up and have him start, whether that's going to be a Domingo Germán when he gets ready, or who's next in line. Who's lined up to give you some coverage in those spots is really important in your organization. The Yankees are well positioned in that regard. So, yeah, I feel pretty confident the Yankees are going to monitor that. And yes, give them breaks whenever you can here and there. And if you're playing well, and the bigger lead you get in the division, that helps as well, that you can hold guys back here and there. So, yeah, you should be worried about it, to answer the question. But I feel good that the team, organizations in general, and specifically the Yankees, have never been better prepared to monitor that situation.
Cortez, 93 innings last year. He's up to 53 so far this season. I'm not really worried about Clay Holmes. It feels like it's much easier to manage the workload for a reliever. He threw 70 innings last year. He's on pace for the low 80s. But as you guys can have seen, it doesn't take long to get a guy back on track. You know, if a guy doesn't pitch for 3 days, all of a sudden the pace is much more back to normal. So that's something that I feel like it's going to be less of an issue, even if it's for someone like Holmes, who's so important to the team.
And so efficient too, the way he fills up the strike zone. How many times have we seen him with 9, 10, 11, 12 pitch innings too? So no two innings are the same.
And Holmes is not foreign to this workload. When the Yankees acquired him last year, he was one of the most often used relievers in the game, even by Pittsburgh. So it's not like he's coming to a new organization, and even with all the new changes, the workload's increasing. This is something that's kind of normal to him, so to speak.
And you mentioned the short innings. If you look at big league pitchers with at least 20 innings of work this year, he has the fewest pitches per inning. He's under 13. So, Cone, you've mentioned before, high stress pitches. It's high leverage, but he's not really dealing with a lot of traffic on the bases, and he's kind of just mowing through people.
Yeah, just filling up the strike zone, pitch after pitch.
We've got one from @cheapgimmick. What pitch do you wish you could have added to your arsenal?
Well, I would have loved to have a parachute changeup. The changing of velocities. That to me, that would have been it. I threw a splitter. I was, when I wanted to change velocity, I threw more of a curveball. I tried to take some velocity off of my curveball, maybe get a little more break to a little more vertical movement on it. That was hard to do, to get tight spinning curveballs and throw them slower. That's what I think is the secret sauce for Adam Wainwright, that he can throw a curveball, in the low 70 miles an hour, but still have it tight spinning, get high RPMs on it, and still have a pretty quick break on it. That's what makes him so effective. I would have loved to have like a Pedro Martinez changeup, the old expression is a lampshade, right? Pulling down the shade, that kind of almost like you could pull it back like a recoil on your changeup that imparted spin on it, but also took velocity off of it. So that, to me, that's the magic formula. If you could still spin it, but yet throw it slowly, those are the ones that are so effective and so hard to recognize for hitters. So that would be it. The pull the ripcord parachute changeup. I wish I would have had.
All right, we have time for a couple more. I want to get this one in because it comes all the way from Israel. This guy says it's at Mike T. Cohen. He said, David, I coach little guys first to third grade here in Israel, some of whom have never seen a real game before. One of the kids asked me if he could become a pitcher. And right now he throws a mean ephus if the hitter is 9 feet tall. He wants to know, other than watching games, where would you get him started?
Just with the love of it. That it really starts in your heart. When you wake up and I remember going to sleep in my uniform, right? We've all heard those stories. Got a game tomorrow morning. I'm going to sleep in my uniform. That started at about 7, 8 years old. That's where it starts, is really the love, the desire, the motivation. If you don't have that, then it doesn't matter. You wake up in the morning, I'm going to play video games, but no, I got my uniform on. I can't wait to get outside and go practice or play this game. That's kind of where it starts. It's in your heart. You teach them the love of the game. And then secondly, it's, what comes from that is just rep after rep. Maybe all of us have played sports, or if those of us who have, you just remember, hey, I'm out in the backyard, or I'm on the field, or my buddies are getting together, and we're going to play all day. And that's the only way you get better, is rep after rep, more reps. I remember my backyard shooting baskets all day long. Hey, Dad, I learned how to shoot a jump shot. I jump like 2 inches off the ground and then shoot it. Look, is that a jump shot, Dad? That's a real jump shot, like the pros. So that's where it starts, right there. It's just the love, the desire. And when you wake up in the morning, what's the first thing you think about? To me, that's the key.
Got one from Sam Duchovny. What is the single greatest confidence boost you can have as a pitcher?
To me, there was a lesson here. When I first went to the Mets, and one of the first starts I had, my first major league start, I gave up 10 runs. I was facing the Houston Astros, and it was on the heel. This was 1987. The Astros and the Mets had a little history there. They met in the LCS the year before, famous league championship series, a 16-inning game. Those of you who know the history of the Mets and the Astros. Well, the next year, I started my first major league game against the Astros and got blown out. And I threw some good pitches, some bad pitches. I balked a couple of times. It was a Murphy's Law. I think there was errors behind me. I had to pitch 5 innings because our bullpen was trashed. Davey Johnson left me out there. out of necessity. By the time five innings were over, there were 10 runs on the board. I was completely embarrassed. It was a Tuesday night game. It was a limited schedule, so that game got a lot of play nationally. Mel Stottlemyre came to see me on the mound in the middle of this. I had my hands on my head like this, like, oh my God, what's happening to me? It was an awful scene. And I remember the next start, I went out and I was throwing some of the same pitches and guys were fouling them off or popping them up. And I was getting outs on the same exact pitches that I threw the previous start that I gave up 10 runs on. And the light bulb went off on in my head that, you know, it's the old theory of you give up some hard hit contact, you change your whole approach. It's the expression of, I got chased out of the strike zone. I got worried. I got afraid of contact. Oh my God, I've got to be perfect. I'm not good enough to pitch up here. Unless I thread the needle and throw perfect pitches right to the corners, that I can't win. And it's just the opposite. When you realize you throw a pitch right down the middle, as I evolved as a pitcher and a hitter fouled it off, I go, okay, that's the break I needed. Now I'm going to get him out. Instead of, oh my God, I just made a mistake down the middle. And, you know, I can't pitch like this. It's very psychological, very emotional. You know, we talked about this earlier in the podcast, but it is a very real thing that is a hard lesson for young pitchers to learn. And that is the lesson. You know what? You don't have to be perfect. You don't have to, don't get scared out of the strike zone because somebody made a good swing on you or somebody hit a big home run or somebody hit a scorching line drive off of you. The next hitter might just pop it up just as well. So that's the moral to the story.
All right, last one for me. And again, thank you all for sending your questions in. They've been terrific. And I promise it's not going to be another 27 episodes before we do another mailbag. So keep sending them in. It is from at Psychoplasmics5. They say, I noticed that Yankees reliever Lucas Litke was talking to himself on the mound. Do you or guys that you know have a mantra on the mound or thoughts or phrases that you repeated to yourself to stay dialed in or calm, or even get pumped up?
Well, yeah, it can vary start to start, but to me, it was always simplifying. It was about a checklist that you had. The more swing thoughts you had, the more mechanical thoughts you had in your mind at one point, the more jammed up you were, the more prone you were to get jammed up. It's hard to do any activity when you're thinking too much about it. What am I doing? Where are my hands? How's my stride? Am I landing properly? Is my alignment right? Certainly you have that checklist before the game and in the bullpen. And then when you're first warming up, you get all those out of the way. But when you're in the heat of the moment, you should reduce that to just one or two. And it's usually based on the feedback of the pitch. There's feedback on every pitch you throw. So what you were trying to do and what the outcome was tells you all you need to know mechanically. You know, I either I'm too quick or I'm too slow. If I'm a right-handed pitcher and I throw one in the dirt on the outside to the outside to a right-handed batter, then I'm too quick. My arm's out in front. And what's my adjustment? My adjustment's usually with my lower half. Just hang in there a little bit longer. Conversely, if I'm trying to throw a pitch down and away and I miss way up and in, how many times do you see that, right? I mean, pitcher's aiming down and away. The catcher's down and away. He threw it way up and in. It happens a lot. Okay, I was too quick. My arm had to rush to catch up. So where's my checkpoint there? What is it? Is there a checkpoint in rhythm or timing? Do I need to break my hands a little bit sooner? Whatever your checkpoint is, try to reduce it to one or two thoughts, because anything more than that is going to jam yourself up mentally and emotionally on the mound. So that's the trick. Know right away, okay, I got to hold in a little longer, or no, I got to speed it up. It's usually too fast or too slow. It's really that simple. I'm a little too fast in my delivery or a little too slow. You need to identify it quickly and make that quick adjustment.
It's a great way to end the mailbag portion of the show here. We got some great questions from our listeners.
Yeah, a lot of them. And we will do this again rather soon. Like we said, we promise. I know the first time we went about 30 episodes in between. So this is fun. Maybe we'll do some voicemails as well to get your voices on the show. And you can drop a VM instead of a message on Twitter. All right. This week in pitching history, James, what do you have for us?
All right. June 2nd, 2010, 12 years ago, Thursday, already been 12 years, Detroit at Cleveland, Tigers right-hander Armando Galarraga retires the first 26 batters he faces. He's one out away from a perfect game. Jason Donald hits a grounder to first baseman Miguel Cabrera, who throws to Galarraga, covering first in time. Umpire Jim Joyce just misses the call, says he's safe. No one could believe it. Galarraga's smile on the mound. He gets the next batter, Trevor Crowe, for a one-hit shutout. But it wasn't a perfect game. Joyce, in tears afterwards, knowing that he missed the call. He felt so bad, a well-respected 30-year career. And it's, you know, it's, on the one hand, it's too bad that, you know, he goes down in history as that. But then you see the way that he handled it and the way that Galarraga handled it. And then the next day, the lineup card exchange was Galarraga himself going out, representing the Tigers, and the moment that he had with Joyce. Just really a great moment and a great example of good sportsmanship. And it just goes to show you need a little luck to get that no hitter or the perfect game.
Random variance of an umpire call, right? I mean, factor that in. Yeah, I've talked to a lot of umpires about that, and I know Jim Joyce very well, and I'm glad you brought that up, James. It's a great example of sportsmanship. If you think umpires don't care about whether they get it right or wrong, you are dead wrong. They do. They take a lot of pride in their work universally. Every umpire I've talked to over the years remembers the calls they missed, just like players, just like pitchers remember games they blew, or relievers remember games, you know, saves they blew, or hitters, you know, on down the line. They do care, you know, even though sometimes you wonder, right? I mean, it's easy to get on umpires. You know, hey, how could you miss that call? You're terrible. You're blind, whatever. All the cliches that you hear about umpires, they care. They really do. Jim Joyce cared. He showed it. It's a great example, James. And what a great guy too, Jim Joyce. Really, really great guy. And Galarraga too handled that very well. A lot of class all the way around. One of the best moments, I think, in recent history that you've seen, interaction between player and umpire.
Yeah, it was something that, it was very much a negative because you want this guy who did it. You want him to get the perfect game. But it almost became like a really nice thing too, just because of the way the two of them handled it.
Yeah. This is the best outcome out of a crummy situation. All right, guys, three up, three down. We give some love to a pitcher that we're going to be watching over the next week, or someone who did something incredible or continues to do something incredible. For the first time, I'm going to go in a different way here. Before I do, briefly give some praise to Tony Gonsolin of the Dodgers, because he's kind of stabilized this rotation in LA with Heaney and Kershaw on the IL. He's been really valuable after kind of like fighting for a spot on in the rotation in spring training. It was pretty cloudy where his status was on that pitching staff, and he has been remarkable for the Dodgers. But I'm not going there. I could go longer with Gonsolin, but watching the games Friday night, you see Justin Verlander pitching for the Astros in Seattle against the Mariners. And Verlander just did not have it on Friday. He obviously looked incredible heading into that start for the season. Was a consensus Cy Young Award winner if you're going to give it to anybody at the quarter mark here of the season. On that night in Seattle, Verlander gives up 4 home runs, 10 hits total. You could visibly see his slider wasn't his slider. It didn't have the command, the feel for his pitch. But as I'm watching in like the fifth and the sixth innings, I'm wondering why on earth is Justin Verlander still in the game? If you think about, okay, the damage has already been done. His team's down 4 or 5 runs and he's creeping up toward 100 pitch count. I think he threw 99 pitches. He was taken out with 99 pitches. So he's working hard in low level spots, driving up that pitch count during a game in late May. You know, this isn't September where the Astros are trying to hold off Seattle for the division. So as good as he's been, he's still working hard in low level spots. He's coming back from Tommy John surgery. So for three up, three down here, I'm thinking, all right, David, I need to ask you here. Are you more like surprised that Verlander was kind of tattooed by the Mariners, giving up all those home runs, those hits, or that Houston kept him in during essentially a clunker in the month of May?
It's a great point, and something that pitchers and managers and pitching coaches have gone through forever. You know, the expression is you hung me out to dry. You know, I'm having a great year and you had me suck up 10 earned runs or whatever. You know, why didn't you protect me? Why didn't you come get me? Well, you have to be privy to all the information in that dugout. You know, Dusty Baker's old school manager, and he's interacting with Verlander throughout that game. Maybe the bullpen was down, or maybe they, you know, who knows, maybe they needed a break. They needed Verlander to push it a little further to give their bullpen a break. But it is a valid point coming off of Tommy John surgery, his age. He had such great numbers going into that game. It was clearly a you know, an equalizer or regression to the mean, so to speak, for Verlander. He was due, as Joan Cohn used to say, he was due for some earned runs. He got them. But yeah, I'm sort of with you that that is the, that's the art to managing pitchers, especially pitchers that are so valuable and that are, have the injury history that Verlander does. That's, boy, do I protect him? Is he okay? He says he wants to keep pushing. He kind of got to be in that dugout. But I always appreciate a manager who protected me. You know, the, hey, you're having a great year. This isn't your day. Let me protect you a little bit and get you out of there. And yes, that can be appreciated. And conversely, I can be really divisive. If you're a starter, I've seen that with starting pitchers. You get really pissed off at their managers because they were hung out to dry to suck up extra earned runs and get beaten up on nights that they just didn't have it going. Yeah, it impacts your arbitration. It impacts your compensation, you know, at the end of the year. It impacts a lot of things, including your ego along the way. So, yeah, you got to be in there to know what the decision-making process was, but at the same time, it's a valid point, Shaq, and a real art to, you know, how do you protect your pitching staff, especially your veteran guys?
All right, James, who do you have for us? Three up, three down.
Shohei Ohtani. Let's not take him for granted. I know he gave up 5 runs against the Blue Jays last Thursday, but he's doing it again. He is not at the same level as last year's MVP year, which he was basically better than Matt Olson in OPS plus, and he was better than Garrett Cole in ERA plus last year. But OPS plus down from 158 to 129, still great. ERA plus down from 139 to 112, still solidly above average. He is a marvel. I don't think I still, even though he's, you know, maybe the most hyped up guy in MLB right now, I still think you can't talk enough about him. What he's doing is absolutely incredible. And I can't wait to see him in the Bronx this week as the Angels come to Yankee Stadium. It should be a good series with 2 contending teams, but I will be focusing on Shohei, hoping he has a little bit of a better, we get to see more of him on the mound on Thursday than last year's first inning knockout.
I remember that game so well. It was probably the hottest day of the year too. It seemed like it was like 110 heat index when Shohei Ohtani started at Yankee Stadium last year. He also was batting leadoff. So as a visiting pitcher, you got to warm up in the bullpen in that heat and then get to the dugout in time to put your helmet on to bat leadoff. So yeah, I was kind of questioning that. Why didn't they bat him third? That would be the time to give him a little bit of a break after he warmed up in this heat. I remember watching him in the dugout before he batted. He was in front of the air conditioner. The look on his face, he was melting. And he was just, the air was blowing on his face before that first at bat after he warmed up in the bullpen before the game. So that was probably the highest degree of difficulty I've ever seen a starting pitcher have to go through. Not only just because of the heat, but he had to bat leadoff after in the visiting pitcher, having to warm up quickly, get your stuff ready, and then get in there to lead off the game.
Yeah, if you blinked, you missed that start from Shohei Ohtani. I remember such a letdown. It was one of the, you know, we all work at the state at Yankee Stadium. That I think stands out, and it's so vivid to all of us because everyone, just like we are right now, anticipating the Angels and the Yankees going at it this week, we were all jazzed up and ready to go to watch Ohtani on the mound. And if you went to the bathroom right before Ohtani took the mound in that bottom of the first, you probably missed it. So
he's larger than life. He really is.
We'll go back to that, the Angels and the Yankees gearing up for a series this week, because there are a couple of other good series. But David, what do you, or who do you have, I should say, for three up, three down this week?
Well, you know, we talked about the Miami Marlins, you know, and their pitching staff. They've had a lot of young pitchers that have come along over recent years. But one guy you've seen, maybe you've heard of, obviously you've heard of him if you're into pitching in the game. But Sandy Alcantara, coming off of a 14 strikeout game, really, to me, is coming into his own. And, you know, if you think about him, last year he had a nice year. In 2021, he had a 3.19 ERA and 33 starts. This year already, in 10 games started, he's got a 2.0 ERA, 2 flat, and 67 and 2/3 innings. We talked about innings pitched. He's averaging, do the math there, 10 starts and 67.2 innings pitched. He's a little shy of 7 innings on average. Really good. He's already accumulated 2.2 WAR on the season here at the, as James said, almost a 30% mark. He's got a bust out year coming. He's on a pace to have a monster year, a 6 or 7 WAR season, maybe more. He might get up in that, you know, Cy Young Award candidacy. He's one to watch right now. Electric stuff. He's always been high velocity, movement, sinkers. His slider is getting better. He's figuring out how to miss bats more. Coming off a 14 strikeout game, watch out for Sandy Alcantara. He's on to bigger and better things. He's a pitcher to watch right now.
Between the lockout ending and the season starting, when everyone kind of had to give their season previews and predictions, I felt like Sandy Alcantara was the trendy pick within the industry on winning the Cy Young Award winner. And for that reason, I overthought it. And I know on here, I picked Brandon Woodruff, who's right now on the injured list. We wish him a speedy recovery, get back quickly, only to, you know, make me look smarter at the very least. But Sandy Alcantara was that guy who I felt like a lot of people were picking. Yeah, I overthought that one. It's pretty simple. He's coming into his own over the last 2 years, and obviously he's figured it out. It's a treat to watch him every fifth day if you are a fan of pitching here. But we talked about the Angels and the Yankees, briefly touched on Woodruff, the Brewers. Those are teams who are in some interesting series this week. So between the Yankees and the Angels going at it, you have the Padres and the Brewers going at it in Milwaukee, David, and you also have the Mets and the Dodgers battling out in Los Angeles. If you want to pick one series, if you want to quickly gloss over the three of those series, feel free to do whatever you want, but what should fans be paying close attention to when you focus on the pitching for those series?
We've talked about it. It's new. It feels like a New York LA kind of year. This is a bi-coastal year, right? The battle for LA, the battle for New York, both teams are good. It's great for the game. I'm with James though. Anywhere Shohei Ohtani goes, I'm watching, the Mets, if the Mets had, a matchup of Kershaw against DeGrom, that kind of marquee matchup that potentially is going to happen later in the year, then I'd say, wow, that's must-see TV. The Mets and Dodgers have their own history, without a doubt. So that's going to be interesting. The Dodgers, wow, what a team. Maybe the most complete team in the big leagues right now, top to bottom. But, yeah, it kind of gets – you get that feeling that maybe this is the year. It's Mets and Dodgers in a league championship series again, maybe Yankees and Dodgers in the World Series, thinking back to Bob Welsh and Reggie Jackson, back to the late 70s and all the drama there. Wow, I remember pitching at Dodger Stadium back in the day. Here I am, back in the day again. Walking off the mound, there's Frank Sinatra over the dugout. I mean, the stars will be out. That's what you get. You get the marquee matchups, New York, L.A., everybody will be there. That's when you start seeing the current superstars will be right there in the front row. Or right above the dugout at Dodger Stadium or at Yankee Stadium or really at Citi Field for that matter. That's when you see them. And those are the games that bring those kind of stars out.
You mentioned the Brewers-Padres series. It's still a few days out, so we don't have all the pitching matchups lined up. But the way things are looking right now, looks like Friday is lined up for Corbin Burnes against Joe Musgrove. That is a circle the calendar pitching matchup.
Appointment viewing right there on your Friday night. There it is. Plans have been made. So hopefully that stays on track there. David, I think we need Dan Rourke to come in with a back in the day bumper for every time that you say the phrase. And I don't know what it'll be. Maybe like an old man groaning with like back pain or something like that. Yeah. Just to deter you from saying back in the day.
Because, back in the day. Got to take a shot. Shot of whiskey. Drinking game.
Yeah. guys, it's been fun this week. And it's going to do it for this episode. Big thanks, as always, to Dan Rourke, our incredible producer. Quick reminder, next week, this show's obviously dropping on a Tuesday. New episodes of this show usually drop each and every Tuesday. Next week, it's going to drop on Wednesday. David's coming back from Chicago. I'm going to be coming back from Australia, of all places. But next week, it'll be dropping on Wednesday, so look out for that. Please rate, review, subscribe. It is the best way that you could support the show here. As we wrap it up, Toeing the Slab, Pitching with David Cone is a production of John Boy Media. We'll talk to you next week, everybody.